for some reason, in that desperate situation, it makes sense to jump. It doesn't make sense any other time, but that's an example of the way that we will panic in a desperate situation. The other thing besides panic that we humans often experience in those moments of desperation is just plain old anxiety. You know, the kind of thing where you can't think of anything else. You can't get it off your mind. Every time you close your eyes, or every time, you know, you lay your head on the pillow, or when there's not something else to distract you, your mind just, you know, returns to that thing, whatever it is, that crisis that's causing the desperation in your life. And a lot of times, you know, it's not unusual in those situations where not only can you not sleep, you know, you toss and turn, and this thing, you know, this movie just won't shut off in your mind. This soundtrack just won't quit, and it goes over and over and over, and you toss and you turn, and you get up and walk around, and you go back and lay down, and you just can't sleep. And a lot of times you also can't eat. You know, somebody, it's time for lunch. No thanks. And then it's dinner time, you know, the table's set, the dinner's ready. I just don't feel like eating. It's not that you make a decision to not eat or not sleep, but that's just the way your body reacts to those desperate times. And I'm sure you know what I mean. God designed into many of his creatures, really, including man, this mechanism called the fight or flight response. You ever heard about that? Probably have. It's not a big mystery. When we are faced with a threat, we will either stand and fight or turn and run. Now, that's almost an animal-like instinct, and it's one of those things where you don't think it through. You don't consider how to react. You just find yourself in that desperate moment, you know, and you either fight, you know, you take a stand and put up your dukes, and, you know, or you know, the other alternative is flight, you know, where you just turn tail and run. Those are self-preservation mechanisms, fight or flight. But there is a mechanism unique to man that God designed into our being. And that is that even in the most desperate situations, the fight or flight mechanism switches off when we know help is on the way. Nothing about the circumstances has changed. The threat is just as real. We're not safe yet, but we know we're gonna be because help's on the way, and suddenly that urge to fight or flee or whatever, it just kind of goes away. See, as children of the King, we don't have to fight or run away. We have a third option, and that is that we can run to the Lord. That's what we see in Psalm 3 and 4. When you're desperate, as we're going to learn from the example of David here, you don't have to resort to desperate measures. All you have to really do is trust the Lord. Now let's read the third psalm, and then we'll get into the fourth one in a minute. Now this starts with a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom. I don't know if this is a major point, but just kind of FYI, that little introduction is not part of the original inspired text. This was added sometime later by the scribes, but it really helps us out because it sets the stage for what's going on. It tells us David wrote this psalm, and he wrote it when he fled from Absalom. Now we'll talk about that in a minute. So David writes, "Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, 'There's no help for him in God.' Selah." Probably should talk about that for a minute. That's a musical term, and all the research that I've ever done on this word, it starts with, no one really knows what this means, and then they tell you what they think it means. And the best guess is, it is a musical term because these are songs, you know, and it's a musical term that means pause. Wait a minute. Now, usually in our songs, not just our worship songs, but Western music for the last several centuries, very often is there a place where the band just stops and lets you think about it. Some symphonies do that. It's beautiful. But that's the idea. It's stop and let that sink in. Let what was just said and what was just played in the context of a song, let that sink in. Let it resonate a little bit. You know, don't just let it blow by like old MacDonald had a farm. Now, stop and wait a minute. Who is old MacDonald? What kind of farm did he have? How big was it? What did he grow? Was it a farm or a ranch? Did he have cattle? You know, stop, think about it. So, many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. Selah. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me. This is that song that we just sang. My glory and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice and he heard me from his holy hill. Stop and think about it. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you've struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You've broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord, and your blessing is upon your people. Stop and think about that. Okay, we got to dig into a little background here. I mean, the Psalms are all, you know, beautiful in their poetry, and we can almost nearly always, well, if you can't relate to one psalm, hang on, you're going to be able to relate to the next one. Because the sum total of human experience, both, you know, good news and bad news, tragedies, troubles that we face, as well as victories in times of celebration, somewhere in the book of Psalms, you're going to find an expression of that feeling, whatever it might be that you're experiencing at the moment. This particular psalm, as it says, written by David when he fled from Absalom. You have to kind of look at that background. This is a sordid tale. It really is. David, you know, the man after God's own heart. The priest came to David's father and, you know, said, I'm here to anoint one of your sons king. And, you know, dad lined them all up and the prophet came by and said, no. Not him. Went down the line. It's not him. It's not him, not him, not him. And he says, have you got any other sons? Because he knew the Lord sent him there to anoint a king. And they said, well, we've got, you know, Davy. The kid is out watching the sheep, but he's just a little guy and, you know, doesn't seem very kingly to us. And the prophet says, well, bring him in. And they bring him in and he says, you are the one. He anoints him king of all Israel. Problem is there's another, you know, Saul. He thinks he's king. But there's a season when the Lord sort of, because of some misbehavior we won't get into the details on, the Lord removes his anointing from Saul and David does in fact become king. And he's, you know, David, or Saul has slain thousands, but David has slain tens of thousands. He was a mighty warrior. Spent years in the desert hiding from Saul because Saul wanted to kill him, although there was really no good reason for that. He had opportunities to go and take Saul out, but he refused to do that because Saul was, in fact, God's anointed at that point. So he's in a tough spot, and he's, you know, finally he becomes king, and after, you know, wars and battles and victories and, you know, in the name of the Lord. In his later years, he's getting, you know, a little gray around the temple, and the army's out fighting, and David, King David, decides he's going to stay home this time, kind of sit this one out. They can take care of business, and you know the story. You can read all about this. We won't read it, but if you're taking notes, in the book of 2 Samuel, it's an incredible story, chapters 11 through 15. Where David, and you know this part of the story probably, he's out on the roof one evening in the dusk, kind of cooling off and looking over the city, and he sees a gal down there taking a bath, which is kind of typical because the bathtub would be on the roof where the sun would heat the water all day, and then when you don't think anybody's looking, you know, there's that moment where you kind of slip out of the robe and into the tub. And David happened to look at just the moment where he got an eyeful, and he, you know, and then his hormones took over. And he said, I like what I see. I like her. And he sent somebody to go get her. And they said, oh, but she's married to Uriah. And he said, well, he didn't say it, but what he his actions imply is, I don't care who she's married to. Bring her to me. And he did, and you know, you don't really say no to the king, and he sleeps with her, and then turns out that she's expecting. That's what happens, isn't it? But now he's in a real fix, because he's got one of his soldier's wife pregnant. And so he goes, I know what I'll do. I'll bring the soldier home. He'll sleep with her. 9 months from now, she'll have a baby. They'll just assume it's her husband's baby. You know, problem solved. So the soldier comes home, and David says, you know, you're doing such a great job out there. Why don't you just go home for a couple nights, you know, and enjoy your wife. Enjoy your, you know, whatever, the home-cooked meals and all the rest. And the soldier, Uriah, says, no, I can't do that. All my brother's soldiers are out on the battlefield. You know, they're sleeping in the, on the ground, and I'll kind of get a spot down here by the gate and nod off for a while. And, you know, plan foiled. Okay, plan B. Here's what David says I'll do. We'll send Uriah back to the battlefield, and we'll send a message to the captain of the army out there, and we'll say, send Uriah up to the front lines, where all the, you know, the real fighting's going on, knowing full well that Uriah would be killed up in that part of the fighting, and that's exactly what happens. So now David's not only an adulterer, he's a murderer. Because in effect, he's had Uriah killed. He let the enemy army do it for him, but he's still of his doing. Well, about this time is when Nathan the prophet comes to David and says, you know, David, and you know this story. David, there was a guy that had a lot of sheep, and he wanted to throw a party for his friend, and instead of butchering one of his sheep, he took the only sheep from this family and butchered it. And what do you think we should do with this guy? And David says, he's got to die. You know, that just ain't right. And then Nathan says those famous words, David, thou art the man. You're that man. And David realizes he is that man. And that's one of the wonderful things where David really comes through here, because rather than make excuses and justify his actions or try to explain away, he kind of says, I am the man. And you can read about where his heart went in Psalm 51, realizing that against you and only you, Lord, have I sinned, done this awful thing. Please don't take your spirit from me. Well, this baby is born, but doesn't live long. It's a tragic situation, loss of a newborn. But David and Bathsheba, as well as his other wives, did I mention David had like 10 wives and who knows how many concubines? And so he has several more children, and the firstborn with Bathsheba is Solomon. You've heard about him, Solomon, the cut the baby in two story, and eventually King Solomon, who had the gift of wisdom. David had a total of 6 sons. Among those sons is Amnon. And then with all of his children, he has one and only one daughter, Tamar. Now, Amnon and Tamar are children of different mothers, so they are half-brother and half-sister. Well, as they grow up, you know, Tamar's a beautiful young girl, and Amnon is kind of a regular, hormone-driven young guy. And the word tells us, it's not just that he had the hots for her. The word tells us that they loved each other. It wasn't a one-way street. Of course, now, Amnon cooks up this plot where he can get alone with his half-sister, and he invites her into his bed. And then she, you know, having good sense, says that would be a wicked thing to do. You know, you're my half-brother, I'm your half-sister. I love you and you love me, but this is just wrong. It can't happen, you know. Well, Amnon then begins to burn, and the word tells us that as much as he loved her, he then began to hate her, because she'd rejected him. She wanted to go talk to David and see at least if there's a chance. If the king says that this relationship is kosher, then we can talk about it. But Amnon is just so angry that she's been turned away that he just takes her against her will. Well, you can just imagine how the family feels when word of this little adventure gets out. Half brother and half sister. The brother forcing himself sexually on his half sister. And you'd think, oh, David is going to, tear this guy up. David is outraged, but he doesn't do a thing. By the way, David is not the greatest father in the Bible. And you'll see that illustrated again and again and again. And this is just one of those occasions. It shows us that for all of his good points, and this fatherhood was not his thing. He doesn't do a thing. Now, Tamar's brother, Absalom, he burns with rage about this thing. In fact, eventually he can't stand it. He leaves home. And he's gone for 40 years. Recognize that number? Little Moses leaves Egypt in the desert for 40 years, or then another comes back when he's 80, however that works. Grew up 40 years, left for 40 years, came back. It's all these cycles of 40, reigned for 40 days and 40 nights in Genesis. 40 years, it's a long time, and the whole time he's gone because he's enraged by the fact that his father did nothing to rectify this situation with Amnon and Tamar. He's really, upset, to put it lightly. Ultimately, Absalom can't take it. He kills Amnon. He avenges, he defends the honor of his half-sister. But then, because of this, he knows when word gets back to David that he's, one brother has killed another brother, that David, will likely want justice to be done there too. So he's gone. That's when he spends the 40 years away off in hiding now from his father because he's murdered the brother that raped the sister. As the world turns, like sands through the hourglass, this is the story of David. And anyway, we get to the point now, and this is where 2 Samuel 15 picks. Oh, by the way, 2 Samuel 14 is a beautiful little kind of subplot about this situation where somebody, kind of like Nathan did, comes to David and said, well, there were two brothers, and one deserved to die, and the other one killed the other brother, and David said, well, that brother must die, and said, well, David, thou art the man. They're your sons, and you won't, welcome the Absalom home, who rightfully avenged his sister's honor, and so forth and so on. Chapter 15 is when the 40 years are over, and Absalom now says, I'm going back home. Me and my army are going back home. He's probably in his 50s, 60s, more at least 60s by now, if not 70s. I'm going back home, and I'm taking over the kingdom. It's mine. Forget the fact that Solomon is the firstborn son. Forget the fact that my father David is still in power. I'm going to go back with my army, and by force I'm going to take over and overthrow my own father. And that, when that threat comes down the pipe, is when David says, Lord, how they've increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. You kind of have to read between the lines here, because what's happening is that there are people in Jerusalem, maybe even people in David's own inner circle, who are kind of pulling for Absalom. You're going to get the old guy out of here. After all, he didn't do anything when his daughter was raped by her own brother. And when Absalom finally set that score right, David kind of exiled Absalom instead of embracing him and saying, thanks, son, for doing what should have been done a long time ago. And so now it's like there are murmurs and whispers, and people are turning against David, and he's talking here about those who trouble me. Many are those who rise up against me. Now, he's really in a spot, and you can imagine this. He doesn't want to run, as if he were afraid. I mean, he's King David. Even if he was afraid, he wouldn't want to let it show. At the same time, he doesn't want to stay there and be killed. And at the same time, he doesn't want to kill his own son. Now, if anything's going to keep you up at night and make you toss and turn and feel distressed and anxious, kind of trigger that fight or flight mechanism, it's got to be this. There's somebody coming to get you, and you don't want to get got, but you don't want to get them either. So what do? And so you toss and you turn, and that's the mess that he's in. The people of Jerusalem are, mocking him. Our king's a coward. Our king, is not doing the right thing. And he's got this threat. He's distraught. He's sleepless. And then comes verse 3. But you, O Lord. Now, if you don't mind writing in your Bible, that'd be a good one to underline. But you, O Lord. Other places in the Bible, there are situations, stressful situations, and it just says, but God. The two best words in the Bible. And here the two words are turned into four, but it's still the best thing. But God. Here's the mess I'm in. I don't know how to get out of it. It's freaking me out. I got to do something, but I don't know what to do, and so I'm just kind of panicking, and I can't sleep, and I can't eat, and this thing's just tearing me up. But you, O Lord. There's comfort just in that. See, this is the first two verses explain David's problem. The next two verses explain David's deliverance. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. You're my shield, you're my protector, Lord. You're my defender. But you, O Lord, are the one that makes sure I'm all right, no matter what. You're my glory. You're the source of all that I need, and you are worthy of all honor. You're the lifter of my head. I think that's the wording that Old King James uses. You lift up my head. You, Lord, are the lifter of my head. You are the one who turns despair and desperation into gratitude and celebration. You know how it is. Maybe what you remember when you were a kid, or if you've got little kids and somebody does something, and maybe it's an accident. They're playing football in the house because they're not supposed to. And somebody knocks over a lamp or something gets broken, the picture gets knocked down and the glass is broken and the frame is dented, and it's, you come home, just wait till your father gets home. And father does come home, and then what does the kid do? Johnny, did you break that? I don't know. Or if he's got a brother, he did it, But the head's down. The head goes down, the lip comes out. My grandkids do that. My grandpa used to make fun of my lip because I was in trouble a lot. But, some kind of reflex where, there's trouble, and so you hide yourself. You put your head down, there's no eye contact, and you kind of pretend that you don't hear what they say, and you're afraid to say anything because you don't want to make things worse. And then the Lord comes along and puts his thumb under your chin and lifts up your head. And what you see is not an angry face getting ready to come down. What you see is a smiling father. He says, it's going to be okay. Yeah, things are a mess. That's a fact. But you know what? Look up. The lifter of my head. I love that picture. I cried, it says in verse 4, I cried out. I cried to the Lord with my voice, And he heard me. I didn't cry out to the Lord and he ignored me. Or he didn't hear me. He heard me from his holy hill. Sometimes doesn't it seem like God doesn't hear? I'm trying to think back in my kind of, cry out to the Lord times. And to be honest with you, usually nothing happens right then. And so I think the Lord didn't hear me. Or the Lord doesn't care. Or the Lord's ignoring me. Or maybe there is no Lord. Maybe this is all just a bunch of baloney and a fairy tale. But you know what? If I keep on trucking, eventually comes that time when, I don't know how it happened, but the pressure's gone. And instead of walking around like this, I'm walking around like this. The Lord does that. And it's in my experience anyway, usually not immediately. He doesn't respond when we want him to, the way we want him to. But you, O Lord, are never late. He always comes in right on time. So, David's deliverance. Now, the next couple of verses tell us about David's confidence in the Lord. Look what he does. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. And I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who've set themselves against me all around. When you're freaking out, when you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off, you lost your job, you lost your family, you lost whatever, and or your the doctor says it's the big C, and there's nothing, not much we can do now, and you find yourself kind of with that dazed, desperate look and feeling. Do you feel like laying down and sleeping? No. You feel like throwing a fit. You feel like freaking out and crying and screaming. Maybe throw some stuff, break some things, you know, because you don't like the news. You don't like the situation. And David here, just as freaked out gets, he calls on the Lord and he has such confidence. Now remember, the deliverance hasn't happened yet. Absalom's still coming. The threat is just as real. And David still doesn't want to kill Absalom, still doesn't want to be killed by Absalom, still doesn't want to be seen as a coward by his people. He lays down and sleeps, then he wakes up. He doesn't toss and turn. He doesn't recycle the same nightmare around and around in his thoughts, you know, thinking that he can resolve it. I laid down and I slept. And I won't be afraid of 10,000s of people. Absalom and his army, what's he got? A few hundred? A couple thousand? I don't care if he brings tens, plural, tens of thousands, or anybody else for that matter. I won't be afraid of them. I won't be distressed and desperate over them. And then in verse 7, David prays. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You've broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord, and your blessing is upon your people. So these last couple of verses in Psalm 3 here, David kind of, you know, he speaks in the present tense about a future thing. Because as far as he's concerned, his deliverance is a done deal. Why? Because God is God. But you, O Lord, problem solved. Freaking out, and rightfully so. But you know what? God is good. God will take care of me. And so he speaks about this as though it were a done deal, even though he can't see it yet. Now, a couple of these figures of speech here, you've struck all my enemies on the cheekbone and broken the teeth of the ungodly. You know, you don't want to see God as some kind of road warrior that comes in, you know, breaking teeth and smashing people up. This is figurative language here. And what he means is when he says that you've struck all my enemies on the cheek, it, you know, it's kind of like you've smacked them in the face. In a sense, it's how dare you? What are you thinking? Why would you do this? How can you do this thing? You know, it communicates that their actions against David or against you, if you put yourself in this thing, are really an insult. Not so much to you, but to God. How dare they? You know, smack. Remember those, like those old thing movies and stories where there would be a duel and the first thing they do is smack each other on the face with a glove? That's kind of the idea, you know. It's like, hey, buddy, wake up. What are you doing? What are you thinking? So you Lord, will smack them up alongside the head. And you, God, again, speaking in the past tense of a future action, have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Boy, that is not a pleasant picture. I had a guy one time call me up and say, I'm going to come and kick your butt. And I'm kind of going, well, please don't. And then he said, and I always go right for the teeth. And I can just imagine myself, you know, with a bloody mouth and teeth on the ground. I'm going, God, I don't want this to happen to me. This is a long time ago. Never mind why. And he never did it, you know, but he was, boy, he sure got my attention. But the idea here, you know, broken the teeth. Well, what happens when somebody has broken teeth? It means they can't bite anybody else, can they? So what he's saying here with this figurative language is, Lord, you know, not only, you know, are they sort of get their attention with this smack on the cheek, but you leave them unable to hurt again. Leave these enemies unable to hurt anybody again. And in verse 8, salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people. See, ultimately, God gets all the credit. And I think this is where we forget sometimes. We get into these situations, and maybe it's not the end of the world, but it's a hassle. It's a pain. And we lift it up to the Lord, or we put it on the prayer chain or whatever, and the phone calls are going, and the emails are flying out, and everybody's stopping what they're doing and say, Lord, would you help so-and-so with this and that, and thank you, praise your name. And then, you know, weeks or months, a season goes by, and the problem goes away. The problem gets solved. But we forget that moment of crisis, and we forget all those prayers that went up, you know. And what he's doing here is he's reminding us is that God gets all the credit. It's not a coincidence when prayer is answered. It's not just fate. Oh, everything just worked out. Oh, I asked God to help me, and then when it worked out, it just worked out. Wait a minute. Salvation belongs to the Lord, and your blessing is upon your people. Stop and think about that. Okay, we move into Psalm 4, and it follows a similar pattern. Psalm 4 doesn't give us an exact occasion, but the sentiment is a whole lot like number 3, and maybe that's why the people who compiled these Psalms put them in this order, because thematically, they're very similar. This is to the chief musician with stringed instruments. You know, he said, I don't want any horns on this. Just guitars and banjos and stuff. And stringed instruments. A psalm of David. Now, what we're going to see here is a similar pattern. It kind of breaks up in its verse 1 and then jump down to verse 6. And we see the petition that David presents in this song. Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress, so have mercy on me and hear my prayer. And then a similar pattern in verse 6. There are many who say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You know, recall your past deliverances. You have relieved me in my distress. You know, you've always come through, Lord. But here I am freaked out again, and I kind of have to put myself through this process where I remember that you're God and I'm not. And that's a good thing because you're a whole lot better at it. And you know what's coming and I don't. And all I see is what's right here. And you see the big picture and the light at the end of the tunnel. Lord, you are the light at the end of the tunnel. And so, Lord, you know, hear me when I call. And you know, I remember that you've relieved my distress in the past. Lord, my righteousness, God of my righteousness. I like the way that NLT has this verse. It says, hear me when I call, God who declares me innocent. See, that's Old Testament language for the New Testament doctrine of justification. I'm not righteous. I'm a sinner. My nature is to rebel against God, but God declares me righteous. And so he is my righteousness. And David recognized that too. On his own, he had no righteousness. He calls on God who is his righteousness. Have mercy on me. That's why we sang that song too. It just seemed like a good fit. This is not the word, the word usually translated mercy. This is the word in Hebrew usually translated grace. This could be, and I think probably more correctly, and I don't know the New American Standard may actually do this, or the ESV, translate it, Lord, be gracious to me. Be gracious to me. Asking the Lord to be gracious is a sort of a confession of our unrighteousness and our own unworthiness. Lord, well, it's like I've said a million times and will continue to say, God's grace is the fact that He loves and accepts you just the way you are, not because of anything about you, but in spite of everything about you. He says, Lord, be gracious to me. In spite of everything about me, love me, accept me, welcome me. And at the last, in verse 6, you know, at the last part of the verse, Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. Lord, let your light shine in this darkness. I'm hurting. It's awfully dark here. You know, the wolves are at the door. Lord, turn on your light in my life. What a great prayer. What a great petition. Now, in verses 2 through 5, we have this call to repentance. It's framed a little unusually, or not, it's indirectly, I guess is what I want to say. But if you look at it, you'll see that it is exactly that. Now, first he's talking, hear me when I call, O God. Now he speaks figuratively to the people. How long, O you sons of men, will you turn my glory to shame? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? Stop and think about that. Say law. Does that explain the world we live in? Describe the world we live in or not? I mean, it does. It doesn't take a big emergency, crisis, tragic event to relate to this verse. How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? But that's what the world does. Remember that thing I read last week? I tell you, that's still under my skin. Those that would identify pedophilia. Or, no. Pedosexuals, that's it. Pedosexuals is just another orientation. They like to have sex with kids. Who are you to criticize? Are you kidding me? That's the world we live in today. And he says it so well here. How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. Now, godly doesn't mean perfect, sinless, righteous on your own. There is no such thing as a godly, perfect, righteous human. That's an oxymoron. It's important. It's like good Christian, you know, military intelligence. Jumbo shrimp. Those words contradict, because if you're good, you don't need to be a Christian. We're Christians because we can't be good, because we're not good. But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. Godly means one who is just... godliness speaks of a familiarity with God. Him who knows God. It's not a description of your character. It's a description of your relationship, one who is going after God. The Lord sets apart for himself him who is, you know, going after him. The Lord will hear when I call to him. Because I'm one of those, says David, I'm one of those godly. I'm one of those, the man whose heart is after God. The Lord will hear when I call. Be angry and do not sin. Which kind of answers that question, is it a sin to be angry? Well, no, because he tells us here, be angry and don't sin. Some things are worth being angry about. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Stop and think about that. Again, this call to repentance. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. See, there's the instructions that David wants us to do. You know, first of all, realize that the Lord knows what he's doing. He's set apart for himself those who are after him. He'll hear when you pray. So be angry, don't sin. Meditate, you know, chew on within your heart, God's goodness, that is, on your bed, and be still. It's not a command. You better, you know, my mom used to tell me, stop wiggling, you know, hold still. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's, hey, man, relax. It's going to be okay. Stop stressing and straining. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness, which is confess your need for the salvation that comes by grace through faith. and put your trust in the Lord. See, there's a one-word answer to this dilemma. What do you do when you're desperate? You trust the Lord. I've been in a lot of desperate situations. I mean, some kind of piddly, but some pretty major. Like the guy that wanted to knock my teeth out. Of course, I didn't know the Lord then, so I didn't have the opportunity to practice this. But I got to say, I've been fired. I've been turned off by the phone company and the electric company. I've been evicted. I've been accused unfairly. I've been through all this life, you know, of an irresponsible person. And you know what, though? It's always worked out. I've never had to sleep on the street. I've never missed a meal. Huh. You know? I mean, when the phone was off, the phone came back on pretty quick. When the lights were off, they were back on in a while, and I got evicted, and I found another place to live. It always works out. So rather than freak out and be in this desperate state of mind with the fight and flight and all that stuff, just put your trust in the Lord. That's repentance from acting like God isn't there and God doesn't care and God's not in control and He doesn't have the power to take care of what needs to be taken. Just trust the Lord. Trust the Lord, and then he kind of comes back in a minute here to this idea we already talked about. There are many who say, who will show us any good? There's the doubting world. You know, go ahead and call on your God. It won't do you any good. You might as well call on Mighty Mouse, you know, or Mickey Mouse, or Goofy, or Donald Duck. Who's going to help you? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance. Let your light shine. You have put, and here's the last two verses where David kind of, after this call to repentance, now he kind of gives an affirmation. You know, when he says, trust in the Lord, now he affirms that that is exactly where his head and his heart are at. You have put gladness in my heart, more than in the season that their grain and wine increased. I will both lie down in peace and sleep. I love that picture. You know, everything's okay, I'm just going to kind of drift off to sleep here. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. See, in verse 7, you've put gladness in my heart. Compare that to up in verse chapter 3, where he talks about being in distress. You know, gladness replacing distress. More than in the season that their grain and wine increased. You know, even more than when everything was just smooth sailing. And things seemed to be, everything's coming my way. You know, even more than in those times when I'm just kind of, you know, floating, everything's cool. Even more than that, Lord, is the gladness that you put in my heart in the worst of situations when I just remember to trust you. Sleep, you know, a picture of relief. All thanks to the Lord. You alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. My little dog, Bink, likes to sit in my lap. And sometimes she sits in my lap and she's kind of got this posture where she's poised and ready to jump in case there's some food somewhere. In case the other dog comes in with a piece of bacon or whatever, you know, she's on it. But then she has this other thing where she turns around and puts her nose in my armpit. I guess she likes that. And you know, and her ears are still out, kind of, she's listening, but her eyes are closed and she's tucked away. And Mary always says, well, she's in her happy place. Because she just snuggles in. You don't have to put her there. She does it, even if you don't want her to. She climbs up and she tucks her nose in and she just is in her happy place. Well, that's the picture here. You, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Lord, you are my happy place. My situation is desperate. But you, Lord, are my happy place. Remember in James 1 is a verse that makes you want to scratch your head because he tells us to recognize it as an opportunity to experience pure joy when the whole world is coming at you from every direction. And you think, well, how is that possible? You know, what in the world are you supposed to, how do you do that? Well, the same way that you learn to trust the Lord when the situation is desperate, it is, first of all, a learned behavior. It takes practice. David had lots of practice. He spent the first part of his life on the run from those people that wanted to kill him for no reason. He had lots of time, ample opportunity to think it through, pray it through, and practice trusting the Lord. And time and time and time and time and time again, the Lord came through and proved to David that he was faithful, that he was trustworthy. And then here, back in Psalm 3 or Psalm 4 as well, in the later part of his life now, the situation was every bit as threatening, every bit as troubling, every bit as desperate. And here is where all those years of learning to trust the Lord paid off. He was able to just give it to God. And so are you. So can you. The world's crashing in around you. Your past is killing you from the inside out. But you, O Lord, lift my head. You, O Lord, you defeat my enemies. You give me rest. You keep me safe. And you give me life. That's what you do when you're desperate.